the UCR Podcast.
Michael Hampton, some of you out there know him as Kid Funkadelic, the legendary guitar player who has played music with funk icon George Clinton for more than 50 years now. Michael has started rolling out a series of EPs that will also eventually include a full-length album, and we spoke in December leading up to a very cool show that he played at the beginning of this year with P-Funk at the Detroit Opera House, where they played with a full symphony orchestra and guests like Vernon Reid of Living Color. And UCR's own Gary Graff was in attendance for that concert. You can read his write-up on that incredible night at our website. Today, we're talking with Michael about Into the Public Domain, the first EP, and how he hopes that fans, and particularly musicians, will take the music and keep the conversation going. You can listen to his new EP wherever you get your music or buy copies at michaelhampton.bandcamp.com. We discuss a number of things today, including his early days learning to play in his hometown of Cleveland, Ohio. And at one point, I asked him about some of the concerts that he went to see early on, and he mentions seeing Yes at Cleveland Municipal Stadium. And I was looking up the various Yes concerts from the Cleveland area over the years, and timeline-wise, it's a bit funky, but Yes played the stadium, as some of you will know, in 1975 as part of the World Series of Rock, a bill which also featured Joe Walsh, the Michael Stanley Band, and Paul Carrick's Ace. Google World Series of Rock if you've not seen these lineups. Those were some great bills, particularly the one in July of 1979 with Aerosmith, Ted Nugent, Journey, Thin Lizzy, AC/DC, and Scorpions. Now, how much would you have liked to have been at that concert? But we're getting off track. Michael also digs into the story of how he learned to play Funkadelic's legendary Maggot Brain. And folks, it was just so much fun to spend a bit of time with Kid Funkadelic. He's a character and still has a lot of love for what he does, as you're going to hear. It is Matt Wardlaw. Thank you for being here on the UCR Podcast. Don't forget, we got you covered. If you want to grab some music, P-Funk or otherwise, store.ultimateclassicrock.com is the place. Use my code Wardlaw15, that is WARDLAW15, and get 15% off your order. And the other thing you don't want to forget, make sure and grab Michael's new EP, michaelhampton.bandcamp.com. Enjoy our conversation with Michael Hampton, and thank you for listening. Here's where I'm going to start, man. And as I was getting ready to talk to you, I came across a post in the P-Funk web forums from a couple years ago. One of the folks there wrote, "Eddie and the Ant Hill Mob were an early 70s funk band out of Cleveland, Ohio. Personnel listed on the 1972 track, The Number Runner, included Ezra Eddie Robinson, singer Ramon Melton, Mike Wilson, Norman Robinson, and Kenny Clay, and get this, 15-year-old Michael Hampton on guitar." So they ask, is this an early recording of Michael before he joined P-Funk? And he goes on to say, "I'm wondering if anyone on this forum has a direct line to Michael and can confirm that he's the teenage guitarist playing on this track. There is a lengthy guitar solo on part two." So figure no better person to ask that question to than Michael Hampton himself.
Yeah, well, I mean, Eddie Robinson, he had Ant Hill Mob, the bass player, and then it was Ed Sparks, but that's not who they're talking about. And I was wondering why Eddie Robinson was seeking me or whatever, you know, how we ran into each other. But don't remember doing any like studio recording with him or anything like that, you know. And that's the first I heard of, you know. As time goes on, you know, I don't know who this, I don't know who said that, you know, but I've heard, you know, quite a few different versions of people's connection to the funk, and then I'm tending to really just kind of let it go, because to get into it, it just I knew Ed Sparks, you know, and he did a after party, you know, when the funk came to town, like at the public hall. I think it was Bloodstone was there, and Funkadelic, you know, and they had a party after that, you know. But and that's when they seen me, and et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, it's the first I heard of that. I mean, I could ask a few more people that, you know, how did that even surface? How did it get to this point? You know?
Yeah.
That's great.
Well, so one of the other people weighed in on that whole thing and said they've never really come across interviews where you talk about your kind of pre-Funkadelic early bands and things you were doing back then. Can you kind of take us through what those early days looked like in a nutshell?
Yeah, like it really wasn't much of a, for starting, I was just putting together anybody that could play an instrument, you know, and turns out that it was one saxophone player, Tyrone, and the drummer, Donnie Green at the time. That's the first band, so he didn't want to call a band. It was a saxophone player, a drummer, and myself. And we were just, you know, just jamming around on little porch, you know, and playing our little lines and stuff, you know, nothing like a real a band, you know. I mean, later on, I got to play some places that probably weren't too popular with the Musicians Union. It was like actually be on the list, like, this place is not. But they, you know, as a novelty, they let some younger kids come in there and play. I mean, it wasn't too bad, you know. And being that we were young, you can kind of get away with being like maybe just more, not as terrible as they, but, you know, it wasn't too bad, you know. But I can't say I had like a band, you know. But that Ant Hill Mob sounds familiar. And I just remember that he was playing, he was just playing Papa Was Rolling Stones. And I was, you know, wah-wahing on the part, you know. And it was just him and I at just one place, you know, playing. And maybe Leo's Casino, it was another little spot,
yeah.
You know, like, and it, just before that closed, that little stage, you know, I got up, I could fit up there at one time, and just messing around. But yeah, I don't think I had I didn't have a bona fide band, no. It was just joining some other people that wanted to play, like Ed Sparks, you know, the late Ed Sparks, yeah, he was trying to start a band, and Electric Sparks, I think, you know, that might have been it in a nutshell right there.
Well, you know, I love seeing in the mix of this new EP that you have coming out, I love that you have Phil Keggy playing on some stuff, and it doesn't seem like it's a reach. Did you guys know each other back in your Cleveland days?
No, we didn't. That's what, I mean, I heard of Glass Harp, but that was a great name, you know, and I think I probably did hear, you know, his recordings and stuff, but I don't even think I was plugged in I was not as serious, I guess, as just pursuing, you know, and going out and let's put something together and write something or not. I'm still pretty a little awkward about that, but the fact that he's from Cleveland and all that, maybe I mean, not just because he's from Cleveland, but yeah, it would be nice to meet him at some point, you know, before we both get out of here. But yeah, here's a lot of great musicians on there. I've just been moving so much. It's like makes it sound like I'm really, really busy, and it's more like traveling busy than it is anything else, you know, like you travel, play, but yeah, I don't even know how, like, the reaching out and getting people to say, hey, you should play on this album, hey, you should play, you know, or can you, you know, so I'd have to ask that question myself.
I think some of the best music, Michael, has kind of a murky story as far as how it came about, so I kind of like that.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That's good. It all works, you know. I mean, that's life, you know. You got to take the good and the bad, you know.
Yeah, and you know what, man, this EP, like, it's 22 minutes, and I know that there's more, you know, I'm going to talk about there's more beyond that, but like, even in the 22 minutes, man, there's a lot of different things going on. Like, some of the stuff that I really liked was, I love what you got going on Steve's Cadillac. I love Technicolor Mobile Home seems to be kind of one of the standouts on this EP. Like, you're kind of all over the place on this creatively, and it just had to be a lot of fun to work on all this stuff.
Yeah, just get in the studio and pretty much laying some overdubs over some ideas that a lot of us have just come to be writing. You know, some things stood out more than others, like to you. But I hope that we can keep going like that. You know, it's just sent not to think on it too much and just get something going out there. You know, just get something out there. So I'm glad you found something that you like.
Yeah, and I think it's fun too, man, because for people that don't know, this new EP is called Into the Public Domain, and the scope of the whole thing is going to be two EPs and an album throughout basically, you know, end of 2025 here into 2026. And the title of what you're calling it really kind of provides the mission statement. You're putting this music out into the public domain and providing the pieces and parts so that people can take what you and the collaborators have imagined and created and really further develop the development using their own imagination. And Michael, I think that flies pretty close to what you've been about musically with a lot of the stuff that you've done over the years with P-Funk and otherwise. But how did the idea kind of come to mind to put this new music out in that way and kind of encourage the creation process to continue like that? Because it's very cool.
Can't take credit for the idea of doing that because there's such a team of people working with me, and everybody's got their own forte, but I haven't met everyone, you know, personally.
Sure.
But yeah, it's sounds a good idea, and they got the, from what I can gather, they have some cards, and then they have the QR code. I don't know if you got all the information on that, and
I
I'm like,
did.
well, so you're gonna become Pokemon, you know, like that. I mean, like, you know, if somebody wants to collect something, but they can also get the individual stems, you know, from each track, you know. So yeah, I hope we can all connect on it, you know, like whoever picks up on it, and hopefully continue doing it like that, you know. And then you're not trying to, hey man, that's mine, and hey man, it's like, can it just be ours, you know? Look here, basically. Hey, use that, you know, so just make it work, you know.
But people can get this stuff on album, CD, and digital. And I love that you mentioned the trading cards as the additional method of distribution because, Michael, that makes me think of all the crazy ways that record labels would come up with to promote albums back in the 70s and 80s, particularly. If we look at back then, like, what's kind of one of the favorite ways that you remember that your music with P-Funk or otherwise was promoted by a label that was creative because, like, they did all sorts of cool things, whether it was like packaging the albums in a unique way or just coming up with an outlandish promotion that they would invite the public to come and be a part of. So there were some crazy things that went down all in the spirit of promoting an album back then.
Sure. Yeah, I wasn't a part of all of who coordinated all of it. I mean, the contests later on when people would come, you know, well, who's got the funkiest contest, costume, or you know, just that and the other. But yeah, all those ideas, I guess, were given to like a team, you know, team of people, which I never really did. I might have seen them, but I didn't know what they really did, you know. It's like everybody's
Yeah.
in the group. It's like, I'm with the band. I'm with the band. Okay, you know, just
That's
keep it moving, you know.
fantastic, man. Well, if we go back to Cleveland, one of the regular things in the 90s was that George and P-Funk would come through here in Cleveland and play the Agora at least once a year. And you mentioned earlier, you mentioned the show that Funkadelic played at Public Hall. Pretty legendary part of your origin story. But for you as a music fan, before you're really into all of this, where were you going to see shows? Like, I mean, you mentioned Leo's Casino. Like, I wondered what some of the shows were that kind of are burned in your memory that you went to see as a music fan back then that were important, ended up being important inspirationally, or just shows that you really enjoyed as a fan?
Well, I think I didn't get too many shows. I think one show I did go to, I think it was Chess. It was at the Cleveland Stadium. I think it had like, I think Jess was there and people. And yeah, man, that's a reach. But I didn't really, I mean, I remember actually wanting to go see Sly and the Family Stone, but I wasn't old enough, you know, so I didn't really get to the concerts I wanted to go to. And then I guess that kind of led to trying to play, you know, just around in the neighborhood or wherever. We'd be in the backyard with an extension cord out the door and trying to play Money from Pink Floyd or something, you know. But yeah, I don't think I got a chance to see a lot of concerts like that. You know, it was just, I would think it was in the budget. You know,
yep.
for the moment, I was borrowing albums from my friends just to learn the things that I did do. You know, like it was any types of songs that they might have liked, I'd say, "Well, look, can I borrow your album?" And then they let me borrow it. And of course, I'd invite them over, play along with the album, and then later on, you know, I could do a little bit more from memory, but yeah, I'm still learning that. You know, I got picked up before I even really got a taste of what a concert is. You know, I think when I seen Funkadelic at the Public Hall, my cousin and I, he knew what time the sound check was, so he just walked us in there. Like way before people started checking for tickets and stuff. So we were up there, you know, we were just in there, you know. But yeah, I guess that's putting that. Oh, you shouldn't put that out there. People are gonna be trying to do that. Hey man, I'm with the crew, you know, carrying ladders in. But
that's a whole other time. But that was a famous part of the time back then when, you know, if it's the classic act like you belong. That was like something you learned back then and you could get in pretty much anywhere. So
sure. That's it. Yep. That's the one. You know,
I love what you're talking about, though, like just that general time period, because that's the time where it's like you're playing as much as you possibly can just because that's what you love to do. But you know, you talked about, like, say, learning to play things like Pink Floyd's Money and stuff like that. That's a time period where any records you can get your hands on, you're absorbing all that stuff like a sponge. And it's like these days that is very easy to do, obviously, Michael, with, like, you know, YouTube and all that kind of stuff. But you are kind of, I think, having stuff served up to you by an algorithm. And it's like, you kind of had like an algorithm back then, because somebody hands you a Pink Floyd record one day, somebody hands you a record by somebody else the next day. So it was similarly curated in a different way, but you got, at that time, you got exposed to so many different genres of music just based sometimes on what people were handing you to listen to. Like, and what a cool way to like start learning to play guitar, I guess.
Yeah, that was a matter of fact. It made me think. I just remember a guy in the neighborhood. His name is Michael Roby, and he lent me my first Funkadelic album with the heads all in it. And so, that's one of the first things. And those licks were, they made sure it was. Well, I don't know if they made sure, but they were simple enough. You know, if you worked at it, you could probably get them, you know. That and what's James Brown, Super Bad. It's just a single, dun-dun, you know, look a little dun, on one string or maybe two. But yes, once it started to kind of like be one with it, like, you know, like I get close enough that I'm doubling it. And you'd feel something, you know. I just tell people, or, you know, some people that play, like, if you really concentrate on playing a certain part or of a song, and you get it and you nail it just right, you may feel something from the artist, you know what they might have been feeling at the time. Because we've all probably heard people play like covers of different things. Some people are like, right, you can't tell the difference. And then some people don't care about the cover. They just smash on it. Like it's like they did the solo. But I believe I got credit making it, you know, somebody noticed me. I wasn't trying to make anybody notice, but when they see me play, it was probably because I had learned that Maggot Brain as much as I could. And then yeah. I was playing it, you know, and I couldn't get away from it. Even now, like I go back to the original from the studio and then I forget that I have my version is live on the One Nation, you know, on that thing. And I'm like, well, I was saying that, well, I wanted to always play like the sound on the record. If I go to see somebody play, I want to hear them play like that or better, or, you know, and I forgot it. I forget sometimes that I did a version and it's like, I'm not doing my version. I'm not doing what I said I was doing. Because Eddie would come out and I would let him start first because he wouldn't follow the contour of the studio mix, you know. And so I figured it'd be better for him to, not that I have a big say-so, but he didn't mind. He went out, he played the first couple of bars, and then he took it to the stratosphere. But you didn't ask that question. I'm sorry, I'm just rambling on here.
No, this is good. I was gonna talk to you about that because you have kind of busted up the myth a little bit as far as you getting the job with Funkadelic by replicating that solo note for note. And the interview that you did last year with Guitar World, you talked about how there are so many nuances within that solo. Even today, you said there's little nuances that Eddie did that I can get close, but you said it's about trying to capture the feeling. And Michael, that last line is important. It is about trying to capture the feeling, and that is something that can be applied to so many things. But if we look at the nuances that you mentioned at that time, what do you think are some of kind of the nuances of Maggot Brain that people perhaps sometimes overlook?
Well, I'm not using some of the bends that he did. And then there, another thing about Maggot, the tone, I haven't taken the time to dial in the tone or ask anybody what he was using or how they actually record it. But I kind of left it alone and, you know, just attached the distortion and the wah-wah and the echo here. But it's so many of them, a tiny bend, like a half of a half step. Like, I don't even know where he might have played it on the guitar. That's what is making me think. Now, I don't know if he played it where I thought it was, or if he played it somewhere else on the neck, what kind of guitar he was using. But yeah, it was so many nuances. But it was also the effects that they had in the studio. And I called it, like, after I found out how they recorded it, it's like a studio baby, you know. It's like an edited thing, you know. And I'm like, oh, well, no wonder Eddie probably wasn't playing it. You know, he probably played what he played. And, like, he wasn't thinking about playing what the record was, because he may have been, like, old school, like, you know, I'm just going to play the first part and then I'm just going to go to the stratosphere with this thing, instead of thinking about the people that just sit home and listen to it over and over, whatever. And when they come to see you live, you don't play like all the little dropouts, you know. Like, I don't even get to those parts now. It's just so edited down. But I would say just the arrangement and how it was mixed, like when it breaks down all the way and then it comes back up, you know. Yeah, too many for me. I would have to go over and be like, okay, that one, So,
yeah.
You know, you know, and I haven't been able to go back to it because I haven't had well the time to do it, and doesn't seem like anybody really, you know, they don't miss that little. They just that they get the basics. If I can cover the basics, then they seem to be fine with that, you know. And I'm really trying to. That's in my head. The original is in my head all when I'm playing, and that's as close as I can get, you know. Without actually sitting down and studio, you know, like researching it, like it's going to be, you know, just putting a whole lot of time into it, which some people probably wouldn't even know the difference. You know what I mean? You know,
yeah.
Okay, that's it. You know, you probably never get it. It's always going to be something.
You know, just generally when it comes to Eddie as a player, how instructive was it for you when you started getting a chance to play with Eddie?
He started to show me things, you know, he played like when he was playing next to me on stage, but I would just have to just observe him playing. I guess at the time, well, I know at the time I didn't have like the patience. I don't know about ADD or what. And then I was experimenting, you know, things just, I was all over the place. And he was the older guy. He probably was like, I ain't babysit, you know, like he didn't probably know what to really teach me, you know? I mean, and I can't really speak for him, but I'm just saying like him being in the band and me being on the scene, he went to, at the same time I was got picked up, I think Billy and him went to Motown and then they did the Shaky Ground and Living in a Glass House, and really everything that I picked up was from just listening. You know, I watched him a lot, but he had like these big fingers, so you couldn't really just tell by looking at his fingers what he was doing, you know, articulating, you know. He showed me, and by just him being around, you know, he didn't ever sit down and say, I think we tried it one time, but nobody really had the time to, you know, he had to go somewhere or I'm busting off somewhere or just the patience, you know, but yeah.
I totally get that. Yeah, I get that from having seen you guys, like just seeing the P-Funk show. I know as like a music fan early on when I first started seeing P-Funk, of course, as kind of a young developing music fan. And I think this kind of gets back to what we were talking about, just the idea of you're trying to capture the feeling. That's what's important. But for me as a young music fan at the time that I was watching everything that was going on stage at a P-Funk show, my thought is somebody who was not that far along as a music fan, and I don't know if you ever felt this way in the early going, but I'm watching this as a fan going, how are they keeping it all together? It just seemed like for anybody on that stage, it would be a lot to keep track of everything else that was going on the stage. So was there a period of adjustment before you found your comfort zone in that? How naturally did that all happen to where you felt comfortable playing a P-Funk show?
Oh, man. You know, I don't think I ever got comfortable. I'm not even comfortable to this day doing stuff up. So I can't say I was ever comfortable. I might have been a few things, but not covered. I'm just, when we rehearsed, I was comfortable. When it started being kind of like we just playing to these songs and it went somewhere else. But yeah, I you know, we probably could keep going on and on about the thing, but I'm starting to kind of double up here to put it one way, but just trying to put some word out about the in the public domain thing, and my comfort zone, even in this, is like I don't think I can ever get really so comfortable, you know what I mean? I have fun when I am comfortable, then it's like it's borderline unprofessional.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, so it's like, okay, so it's trying to balance the two, you know, and I think that's whatever you might have been seeing or interpreting, it might have just been everybody just partying and have a good time and, you know, off the cuff, it was different every night, you know, who, I'll try to leave it at that. It's just to the imagination. You know, it was a lot of partying going on.
Thank you, man. I will let you run on. It was an honor to talk about this new music and otherwise with you. Have a great rest of the day. Thank you, Michael.
Okay. Thanks, Matt. All right. Talk to you later.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.